Please help me give a big Farm Bureau welcome to the Republican candidate for governor, Kenny Hulsoff. Kenny.
Thank you all. I can't tell you how much I appreciate being here because it means I survived Tuesday. And let me just tell you how much I've looked forward to this session. I cannot think of any. Can you hear me okay? I may have to do this. I cannot think of any organization in this state that I feel closer to or with which I have more in common than Missouri Farm Bureau. In fact, some of you may remember I hadn't even been sworn into office yet in December of 1996. And as congressman-elect, you graciously invited me to the annual meeting, and I, of course, jumped at the chance. It was the first time you and I had a chance to get to know one another, and I purposely sat through the entire two-day resolutions process because I wanted to see how Farm Bureau made its policy and learned a lot from you. And that is how I began my relationship with Missouri Farm Bureau most recently, and I will tell you, and I've said this publicly, and I know the press is here writing down every word I say, and that's okay, that the highlight of my congressional career as far as receiving any sort of accolade or award was when the American Farm Bureau honored me with the highest award that they can give to a House member of United States Congressman, and that is the Golden Plow Award. And during that 12-year intervening period from congressman-elect in 1996 until now a lame duck congressman from the 9th Congressional District, but as the Republican nominee for governor, we have had some extraordinary experiences together. I have attended more county Farm Bureau meetings than I can count. You and I have crossed paths at field days. I've welcomed you to Washington, D.C., but more importantly, we have fought the fight. We have done good things for not just Missouri agriculture, but rural Missouri and rural America. And I think back on some of those battles, some that we were very successful and some where we fell a little short. Probably I look back over the biggest regret that's something that I championed and wasn't able to get across the finish line, and that, of course, was the final complete elimination of the federal death tax, because as you've heard me say so many times, death should not be a taxable event. And I believe that long before my own personal situation, when Dad died in 2002, and you know, most of what he knew in farming was up here, and his bookkeeping system was, you know, sticking receipts in the ashtrays of the farm truck, you know, and I had to piece the books together and then sit across the desk from the longtime family friend accountant, and we went through, and every asset he punched in a value, and I knew at the end he was going to hit a total button, and it was going to be above or below some line that arbitrary line that Congress has set. It was long before that personal experience. And let me tell you, my own caveat, Charlie, I've learned this over this last months of campaigning. My fight to get rid of the death tax has nothing to do with our personal situation, but more importantly, to help family businesses go from one generation to the next. And it's unfortunate, especially in agriculture, that 7 out of 10 family farms don't make it to a second generation, and 9 out of 10 never make it to a third. You know, with those two little girls, Casey and Hannah, the most important thing for me right now, regardless of this election, is to become a Century Farm and be able to pass that family farm on to them, because it's now, I understand the legacy nature of that family business that Mom and Dad put together. But we came short on that, but we had other great successes. We fought the Endangered Species Act, and we had common sense reforms. We've talked about a voluntary animal ID, exploration of energy supplies, biofuels, locks and dams, saving seed parameters, making sure that animal feeding operations aren't subject to Superfund regulations, the Missouri River fight, and on and on and on. And I've stood with you, but not just because of the policies, but because I'm one of you. You know, in the most recent farm bill, and what's interesting is when we talk about agricultural generally, and certainly here in the state of Missouri with the challenges that we have here, You know, we had this most recent farm bill fight. And when we had the vote on the day, I think that the day we were overriding the president's veto, Chicago Board of Trade had the price of corn at $5.87 that day. And boy, there was a lot of hand-wringing about how can we provide a safety net or even subsidies for people in agriculture. And, of course, the first response was that 16 cents out of the farm bill dollar potentially goes to production agriculture. It's not a guarantee, but if the bottom market were to bottom out to provide that safety net and for food aid and things of that nature, 74 cents of the farm bill dollar going to help feed people, you know, with school lunch programs and food stamps. And so that's the first misnomer, was that these subsidies, these heavy subsidies, were going to production agriculture. And I became very mindful, even going back to those days as my ag econ degree and, you know, being a state officer in the FFA, we were telling the story of agriculture back then. And I remember, you know, the state fair is now open, and we used to go to the state fair, and we had the petting zoo, and, you know, trying to help kids from the city understand what kids from the country already knew about agriculture. And yet in the halls of Congress, and certainly here in our state, helping people understand the unique challenges of agriculture. And as we had that farm bill debate, it was mindful to me that as we get farther away from our connection to the land, there's just a great misunderstanding by the general population about the challenges that we face. And I think the quote I used on the floor on that debate of the bill was, and it was a quote from President Dwight Eisenhower when he said that farming looks easy when your plow is a pencil and the nearest cornfield is 1,000 miles away. And I think I also quoted a plaque that's in my good friend Colin Peterson's office, the chairman of the Ag Committee, a Democrat, helped bring him to state meeting, because agriculture should not be caught up in the red-blue politics of the day. It's not Republican, Democrat, it's an American issue. And so I proudly helped Colin to come here, but Colin has a plaque in his office, and it says, if farming were easy, congressmen would do it. Well, I am a farmer, and I'm the son of a farmer, and I'm the grandson of a farmer. And so when I stand shoulder to shoulder with Missouri Farm Bureau, it isn't just as a legislator who gets the policy that you promote. It's someone who lives the life that you live. That's why I've never taken you for granted. And you've responded equally. You know, we've had some successes, and again, we've had some challenges. And most recently, of course, in this primary battle, who would have thought that ethanol would have been such a prominent issue in a Republican primary for governor? Look, I understand. Look, we all understand. Everybody in this room understands the cyclical nature of agriculture. And the fact that, you know, one segment of agriculture is doing great guns and another has great challenges. And were it the case that every single year that we would have both livestock folks making big profit margins as well as the row crop folks, and yet that's not the nature of agriculture. We have challenges. And, of course, your Chicago Board of Trade, the price of corn has come down $2 in the last month or so because we're going to have a bumper crop, nearly 87 million acres, the second largest crop since 1946. And so we hurt when the livestock guys hurt, just like I'm sure they felt for us when Hurricane Katrina came through. And I remember getting off the combine in September of 05. The Chicago Board of Trade price for corn was $2 with a 60-cent negative basis at the local terminal. And so for those who had to go straight from the combine to the river, we're getting $1.40. And that wasn't meeting the cost of production. And I'm sure the livestock guys, while they were feeding cheap corn, understood the challenges that the row crop folks were having. And so what really causes me angst in the political arena is when there are those that would try to drive a wedge between us at a very time when we have to rally together in agriculture because of all of the challenges from outside and people that are trying to change policies here not based on sound science, or to try to somehow decimate the number one economic industry in our state. And so while we're trying to circle our wagons against all of those outside influences, for people then to try to pick us off and drive a wedge between us, well, that's tough. And so here comes this ethanol issue. And it would have been, for some perhaps, I guess, who would have maybe wavered a bit. For those of you who know me, and I see quite a few of you that I call friends, you knew that I was not going to waver. You know, I go back to the days when I was on the Ethics Committee in Congress, an equal number of Republicans and Democrats, and the Ethics Committee was charged with, unfortunately, yes, while we hold our public servants up to a higher standard, sometimes we fall short. And so when there was an allegation that a member of Congress had bribed another member for a vote on the floor of the House, I was called then to take this issue on and investigate it. And so my subcommittee, two Republicans and two Democrats, we began to investigate this thing, and the long story short is it led to the second most powerful man in Congress. And while he had not offered a financial bribe to another member for a vote, he had offered a political quid pro quo favor in order to get that other member to vote for this bill, which was a clear violation of ethics rules. And oh, by the way, that most powerful man happened to be named Tom DeLay, who was a Republican. And so then we're confronted with this information. And the facts weren't in dispute. What do you do with it? What I did with it was the only thing I could do with it. Write a report condemning the Republican leader as having violated our House rules and publicly reprimanding him and censuring him. You know, you've seen the ad. I don't want to parrot the ad that some of you have seen in some of the markets around the state, but the one with my dad's truck in it. In fact, how many of you have seen the ad? I just want to see. Okay, good. We pay for these ads. You wonder if people see them. You know, it's kind of good that, all right. But the point is, you know, Dad's saying was the only thing worth keeping in life is keeping your good name. And so you put a report out there and you let the chips fall. And where the chips fell just happened to be they kicked me off the committee. But you know what? I went into Congress with my good name intact, and I come out with my good name intact. And so when we had this ethanol fight, it was just simply, look, here are the facts. And we may not agree, but hopefully people in the state will respect people who stand on principle and values. And that's exactly the kind of governor I will be. Happy to take your questions.
All right. Thank you, Kenny. We'll open the floor now for questions. And raise your hand if you have a question. We've got roving microphones, and we'll bring a microphone to you, state your name and your county, and ask your question.
Oh, Steve's got the mic. Steve, I thought you had a question. Not going to let me off that early. Easy. Yes, sir.
Kenny, this pertains to the national, and I'm sure we're supposed to be talking about the Missouri group, but do you think there's ever any chance that the Ethics Committee will rise to what they're supposed to be doing? Thank you.
Unfortunately, and when the Speaker of the House, he called me in his office, and he was hoping that I would voluntarily step down from the committee. And I did not want to make it easy for him, that if he wanted me to go, he was going to have to make it a very public show. And I was bitterly disappointed when, in fact, then he did just that. But I served at his pleasure, and this was the former Speaker. But what it was a signal then to other members of the Ethics Committee. And I wasn't the only one. There were two others of us that were removed off the committee. But what it was a signal that we really didn't take seriously the fact that the ethics rules should apply to the most powerful just as they apply to the junior freshman member. And as a result from that, those that were replaced on the committee understood what would happen if they took on these tough ethics questions. Let me take your question or your comment and then bring it to the state of Missouri. We have been talking over these last months now about a host of things. I think this is going to be a pocketbook election. We have been to between 2 dozen, 3 dozen different small businesses, manufacturing, large, small. We're at Seiden Stricker's, a farm implement dealer. We've been to retail establishments. The point being, what is the state of Missouri doing well? What do we need to improve on to grow our economy? Obviously, education is important. Healthcare is important. But as important as all of those things are, the first proposal we put forward back in March or April was an ethics package for the state of Missouri. Because as important as all of those things are, in order for us to accomplish the will of Missourians, it's going to take reaching across the aisle, building consensus, solving problems. And if you don't have confidence in our leaders here in Jefferson City, and if they don't have the will to put partisanship aside to do what's in the best interest of our state, then we start with one hand tied behind our backs. And so the first initiative we put out was a strong ethics package, government reform, a ban on gifts to lobbyists, making sure that we competitively bid license fee offices. Those that are efficiently run, we want to continue to run, but we want to have the most efficient offices, because I know Farm Bureau has one of the offices, but to competitively bid those offices. I mean, all down the line, try to end conflicts of interest. For instance, you shouldn't be on the Housing Commission awarding contributors of yours these housing developments around the state, especially when we're only getting 35 cents out of the dollar that's actually constructing these housing projects. And so we put forward a bold, aggressive initiative because here's the thing. You know, it's time to put away the politics of the past in Jefferson City. And unfortunately, and the good thing is that I come with a fresh perspective. I don't have axes to grind. I don't have scores to settle. I just want to roll up my sleeves. I want to get to work. We see the challenges that we have. And in order for us to accomplish things, we have to be able to put just the partisanship aside. And what's happened, unfortunately, and you've seen this too, is that an idea is introduced up the street and it's rejected out of hand by one side or the other just because of the name on the wrapper. You know, the governor put forward a pretty bold agenda item on more money for higher education, the Lewis and Clark Initiative, the MOHELA plan, and yet there was a concerted effort. In fact, I'm going to step on a few toes here. The guy who's going to be talking to you later this morning did not want Matt Blunt to get credit and worked with my state senator to try to torpedo that bill and filibuster it and kill it just because he didn't want a Republican to get credit. Now, I'm not here to send fireworks up, but that's just not right. It's a disservice to the people of our state when we have partisanship that dictates things where we can't get solutions. And so, boy, I gave you a lot more answer than you gave me question. But I can't tell you how important having confidence and integrity in our leaders. And unfortunately, it wasn't just me getting kicked off the committee. But when I stood on the steps of the United States Capitol back in 1994, that ill-fated campaign, and signed the contract with America and said, I'm for limited government and a strong defense and tax relief and living within our means and a higher standard for public servants. And unfortunately, we lost our way on a number of counts. And that's the reason that Republicans lost the majority, in my view. Sorry for my soapbox there.
Yep. Dennis?
Kenny, we've had some debate the past few years on appointment of judges. Do you have any thoughts about what we should keep, what we have, or change that?
Yeah. Of course, the nonpartisan court plan has been emulated by a lot of states. And for those of you who live on the border, particularly on the eastern side of the state, you may remember when Illinois picks their judges, they do it by election. And boy, oh boy, have you seen some of those ads as far as judges running against judges. And so the idea behind the nonpartisan court plan is very sound, and that is not to get into this back and forth of a political campaign. Having said that, we have to make sure that the commission that nominates to the governor is fair-handed. And I think that there are ways to tweak or change the makeup of the commission to make sure that, I mean, the goal is this. Let's start with something where we agree. The goal is that we should have the most qualified jurist, judge, as a candidate from which the governor can then select, because we don't want the political appointee here. We want people that sit in judgment in cases, in criminal cases or civil cases, to be even-handed. So we want the most qualified jurist, and yet if the deck is stacked in any regard, and here's the other thing that I specifically would like to see change, and I guess this goes back, I'm told, probably to the late 70s, 60s or 70s. The governor used to be able to veto the three nominees sent to the governor. And apparently that was taken away, and perhaps it was abused back then, that the governor would continue to veto and veto and veto until he got the nominee that he was looking for. So I understand not allowing multiple vetoes, but here's the thing. If the commission were to tender a panel of three nominees to me as governor, and if I really did not feel that, those three that they selected were qualified for this particular post, I think that the governor should have at least a veto, one veto over that panel of three, and send the commission back to work again. But the goal is the same, and that is we have to find the most qualified, able jurist to take this position of authority. So I do think that we should tweak the nonpartisan plan to make sure that we're accomplishing that objective.
Hi, Kenny. Rhett Hunziker from Knox County.
How you doing?
Got a question regarding MoDOT. It seems like they don't run their business like a business. It seems like they try to piecemeal and fix things with like baling wire and that kind of stuff instead of spending the extra money and doing it right the first time. Is there a way we can take care of that issue?
Yeah. And obviously this is an issue of vital importance to this group. And this goes back to, I guess, probably even from the 92 plan on, right, Charlie? And, the promise was, which again, back, I remember the governor's race in 92, and the discussion about highways was what? Four-lane highway into every town of 5,000, right? Which is still a sound idea. It's just we got far away from that in the late 90s. I'm not going to fight old battles here. I'm not, again, just, but this organization has been on the forefront of that issue. I do think, and actually the Department of Transportation here has been given awards for how efficiently their office is run, but it's a different, right, it's a different issue than you raised. So let's give them kudos for actually streamlining and having a government agency that runs at least internally like a business. But the question is, are we, you know, like our combine, Dad kept our combine running with duct tape and baling wire. And is that the case? I haven't spoken with Director Ron about that. I do know, here's an example, and of course you up in Knox County, the five counties along Highway 36, and four of the five, and probably one of you represents the fifth county that said no, but said yes to a local transportation district. Yes, we're willing to pay more, so long as we're convinced that the money and higher sales tax revenue is going to go for the 52-mile stretch of Highway 36. And so I applaud. I did not take a position on that at the time because it would be arrogant of me not living in one of those counties, but the counties, four of the five, agreed that that was what they wanted to do. What was interesting was, initially, MoDOT came in with a very high number. If memory serves, it was $200 million-plus to do the 52-mile stretch. Well, the private sector company came in and said, we can do it for $150 million. And then MoDOT looked again and refigured and said, we can also match that. Now, did they cut corners on that? Again, I'm not an engineer, but there are ways to find efficiencies. And certainly as we look forward at these major challenges that we're going to have, I do not think we can raise a gas tax. In fact, one of the things off the table for me is an increase in the state gas tax, which is 17 cents per gallon. We cannot, as we're driving less or more fuel-efficient vehicles and driving more miles and paying less in gas tax revenue, the Federal Highway Trust Fund, whoever takes my place and those that we elect and send to Congress and the next Congress, the Federal Highway Trust Fund is insolvent or is teetering on insolvency. And so then there's the state issue, too. And I think we cannot raise the state gas tax high enough to generate the revenue that's going to be necessary. There are things we can do. Do we go to the private sector, for instance, to build a truck lane along Interstate 70 and lease it to the state? Do we take surplus monies out of general revenue? You know, all the doom and gloom and the prognostications about we were going to have revenues decline, we actually, our surplus went up to $800 million because of the fiscal soundness of the current representatives in Jeff City. Do we take some of that surplus? Do we eliminate the state gas tax and look at a sales tax idea? We can also look at things like design, bid, build, and streamlining the process itself. And again, but not at the same time as far as quality is concerned. I mean, we have to think long-term about these. And again, Rhett, I'm not an engineer, but look forward to working with Director Ron or whoever shall follow Director Ron. But this is going to be a really tough issue for the state in about 2 or 3 years.
Kenny, I'm Jim Freeman from Dinn County. Your opponent in the primary hit you pretty hard on a big spender. Do you want to speak to that?
Yes, sir. Not true. Not guilty. You know, I'm one of the most conservative members of Congress in the country. I have fought for a balanced budget. In the four years that Congress had a balanced budget, I was right there fighting with it. Think we should have had a constitutional amendment to balance the budget. Fought for a line item veto. It's easy to take a couple of votes out of context and say, you know, a big spender here or there. What wasn't talked about in those ads was there were another set of amendments that saved about $13 billion of your tax money. And so I have always respected the fact that who pays the bills? You pay the bills. And more importantly, the fact is over the last 12 years, I've helped you keep in your wallet about $1.6 trillion of tax relief. As far as, you know, getting rid of the death tax or at least making progress there, or getting rid of the marriage penalty or increasing the child tax credit, lowering the tax rates, helping you write off capital expenditures more quickly in your family farms. And so I have a strong record on being a fiscal conservative. In fact, I'm just an unapologetic conservative who, again, stands on principles and values. And unfortunately, in a political season, you know, just like this on these judges, you asked me a question about that. I wish we had truth in advertising, requirements in political ads. Unfortunately, we don't. Yes, sir.
Right here, and then we got a question over here. Go right here.
Steve Audie, Clark County. I was on the school board for 15 years, so mine's going to be a school-related issue.
Okay.
Used to be, when I first started, every 2 to 4 years, there'd be a new governor or a new something, and they would change everything. Then No Child Left Behind came. That's going to be a wall that we're going to hit.
Right.
Starting to hit now. What are your thoughts on education, and what do you propose?
Yeah. And in addition, let me add another, and as school board members and superintendents have already begun to talk to me about putting school buses on the road with $4.45 diesel fuel and the budgets for some of the school districts and what are we going to do. And I don't relish the tough decisions that are going to be made by school districts just on the funding. I mean, just on the operational side of it. Are you still on the school board, Steve?
No, I'm off this
year. My views on education generally is we have to hold, if we're going to hold our students accountable, which we do through our tests, and I know there's a big discussion about whether the MAP test is the right test or whether we should look to some other way to measure. You know, ideally, instead of measuring one fourth grade class this year to last year's fourth grade class or next year's fourth grade class, it'd be nice to see if we could measure the progress of that fourth grade class from the beginning of the school year to the end to show yearly progress. You know, it's tough. And for teachers here in the room, I'm sure we got some, you know, 1 year you're going to have a great class that pays attention, and the next year you may not have such a class. And so, there are assumptions there, I think, that are flawed in that you can compare one year to the next. I will tell you, on No Child Left Behind, we had written flexibility for the Department of Education secretary on dealing with kids with special needs, those that have maybe physical or mental challenges, to pull them out of the testing group. And those that that are having difficulty speaking English or speaking the language, which parts of our state, we gave them the flexibility to help take those kids out of the mix so that we were getting a good assessment tool. But nonetheless, those challenges remain. To me, it's about accountability, and it's about holding everyone accountable. It's about holding you as a school board member accountable. It's about holding our teachers accountable, and the janitors, and the superintendents, and the students. I mean, accountability is a good thing. It's our tax money, and we should do all that we can do to make sure that the mission is being accomplished. And the mission is a simple one, that we're teaching our kids. It pains me to see where we are in certain areas. Fourth grade students, we're still at the bottom third in the country as far as our math scores are concerned. One of the things, as I've gone across this tour of Missouri businesses, is the concern about our workforce, especially for jobs that require engineering skills or technical skills. And so as I go up the scale to higher education, we put forth an idea that we should have a higher education funding formula so that there's some certainty among our higher education institutions about that they're not going to get the crumbs off the table, but actually have a amount of money that they can count on. Now, we are in the second year of three on the MOHELA, the Lewis and Clark Initiative, and so we need to let that play its course. But higher education funding formula should also include tech schools and community colleges and trade schools, because a four-year institution may not be for everyone. One of the businesses, who lives close to Webb City? Anybody? Webb City, Cardinal Scale. Went by, those guys were great. They're consolidating. In fact, they're shutting down their Denver plant and their Sacramento plant, and they're bringing all the jobs to Missouri. It's a Missouri-based company. Cardinal Scale makes the truck scales. In fact, they're coming up with some innovative ideas now that the 18-wheelers don't even have to stop on the highway anymore. They'll be able to you can measure the truck as it's moving, which is going to save some energy, save some fuel. But these guys, they're bringing all the jobs to Missouri because they're loyal to Missouri. Two things, by the way. The Quality Jobs Act and workers' compensation changes were vital for them to bring those jobs back here. So I was asking about the workforce. He said, well, we had an 18-year-old, 19-year-old the other day, and tossed him a tape measure and said, we deal with steel here, so measure out 16 feet, 5 1/4 inches. The kid couldn't do it. Now, is that his fault or the school's fault or the curriculum? I don't know, but the challenge that we have then is to get our young people ready, and we have to start elementary through secondary. But accountability, to me, is key, and not heavy hand of government accountability, but letting you as a school board member. I know the federal government and the mandates and No Child Left Behind, you're right, we're getting ready to hit the wall. Flexibility is important, and we tried to write that in the bill, but more importantly, leaving that close to you to determine accountability, that to me is generally my view on education.
Ed Wallace, Crawford County.
Yes, sir.
With the ethanol being, in your last election as you ran, pretty big problem there, I would like to know, what's wrong? The mandate is 10% ethanol and fuel. Well, is there a coalition being built out there now that they want to get away with this 10% and try to get us back, buying oil back in those foreign countries? Or are we going to stay on 10% and try to keep America strong?
I think I get a sense from your question where you stand, Ed. sometimes you get a question and you don't know, and you just give an answer and you just let the chips fall. Ed, I think I know where you stand. Here, look, and again, it goes back to keeping the mandate, and it's in my questionnaire. I don't mean to take a shot at Attorney General Nixon, but I don't mind putting on paper what I my opinions. And you'll look in there on whatever the page it is that we should keep the 10% mandate. But we have to tell a better story about it. I was on the radio one day and just getting chewed on pretty hard about this. And I said, it's either South Dakota or Minnesota. They actually have blender pumps where you can pull up to the pump and you can dial up to 20, 30%, E85, or down to zero. And he said, I like that idea, the caller. He was an anonymous caller. He said, I like that idea because I would dial it down to zero. And I said, and would you be willing to pay more because you're not going to get the same price? And there was silence on the phone and said, well, I just think we should get rid of the mandate. And look, people have strongly held opinions about it. But the point is, 586,000 barrels of oil a day across the country we don't have to go to foreign countries because of homegrown fuel. Let's don't look to the Mideast. Let's look to the Middle West. And the point is that corn-based ethanol, as you know, and maybe some of your investors, I am not an investor in an ethanol plant. Make that point clear, which got a little murky in some of these ads too, by the way. I've got 330 acres of corn, so if that's a conflict of interest, I plead guilty to that. But out of 87 million acres, I got 330. But the point is that a lot of studies tell us that we'd be paying up to 40 cents more per gallon but for the fact that we have ethanol and biofuels. And we're about to transition. We're about to transition into cellulosic ethanol, wood chips. I mean, imagine some of your scrub timber being able to turn into fuel. What about planting a buffer around my farm of switchgrass? We see a resurgence of wildlife coming back. You take a cutting off of it and make fuel out of it, and the government doesn't have to pay me for it, but I get paid from the private sector. I mean, this is where we're headed. I had a guy in Warrensburg the other day. He may be here. I'm not sure if he's a Farm Bureau member or a PAC trustee. He said, imagine someday you're going to be baling your corn stalks in big round bales. Right now, of course, we mow them and we disc them for organic matter. Imagine someday baling your corn stalks in round bales and bringing them to us, and we turn those into highly efficient biomass pellets that can be used for power generation. Now, there's a guy down in Monette, Missouri, who mass produces windows, and he sees the opportunity. MIT just came out with the ability to take a window and turn it into a solar panel and to do both. You can look outside, but still collect some of the sun's rays in a solar panel, and this guy wants to mass produce them. I mean, wind farms, hydroelectric on the upper Mississippi. We're going to rebuild the locks and dams because we fought for that. One of those dams we're working with the Corps on, and they're reasonable to work with on the Mississippi River, to work with them to make one of those dams into hydroelectric capacity. I mean, we just got some extraordinary opportunities here, but one of those has to be homegrown biofuels. And so when folks say, but what about my food bill? Yes, our food costs are going up. But you know what? Every morning, and I don't say this lightly, this morning I had cornflakes. I have cornflakes every morning. And in the box of cornflakes, there's still about, one report said 7 cents, but there's less than a dime's worth of corn at less than a dime's worth of corn in a box of cornflakes. Now, corn's come off $2, as I mentioned before. I haven't seen the price of my box of cornflakes come down lately. But when you put the box of cornflakes on a truck that's spending $4.50 a gallon in diesel fuel to get to the local supermarket, yeah, our food bill's going up. But because of the cost of energy, not because of this food versus fuel. And look, Ed, this is, well, yeah, I know I'm preaching to the choir, hopefully most of you on the choir, and I will say this as far as beef cattlemen and pork producers here in Missouri, they get it, and then they've also been chafed a bit by some of their members because of this, but look, the fact that our commodity markets are so high, we've set record prices with, beans hit $16, corn was up, seven whatever, wheat. Anybody here actually hold their wheat till it got to $12 and sell it? I haven't met that fella yet. We rolled our contract over from last year, because the freeze hit us. And so I rolled the contract over to this year. Arlen, don't ever take my marketing strategy. Don't ever ask me advice, because that was not the... But the point, the reason, supply and demand. And the fact that the value of the dollar makes our commodities look very attractive abroad, because we've got 400 million Chinese now in the middle class, and they're wanting better diets. I mean, all of these things are the reason that we're seeing these commodity prices. But to heap all of the sins at the feet of corn-based ethanol, well, it is the multinational oil companies who have never liked ethanol, and this tens of millions of dollars in this well-orchestrated strategy, and unfortunately people are buying into that.
Last question.
Yes, Charles Hurst, St. Genevieve County. Switching to another form of energy, you know, we're running out of electrical energy capacity, too, in our country. And the extreme environmentalists have opposed almost every form except perhaps wind power. And wind power can be one of those helps. Ameren is proposing an addition to their nuclear facility there at Callaway, and will be joined probably with Associated, which is a rural co-op, in that effort. Wondering what your thoughts are in regard to the use of nuclear, and secondly, your thoughts on the CWIP, the construction work in progress, that they will undoubtedly ask for, which means they would add that to the rates while construction is ongoing. That's going to be very controversial, I'm sure, but yeah, they believe necessary in that $6 to $9 million cost.
Well, did you say million or billion? I think it's B with a B. It's the Callaway plant is about 30 miles from our house, and I have been a consistent supporter of nuclear. You know, I hate to give the French credit for anything, but, you know, when 70% of their energy needs are through nuclear power, and so our friends in the environmental community, if they're truly concerned about greenhouse gases, then why aren't they embracing nuclear? Because there are no greenhouse gases, and yet they talk about nuclear waste and the spent fuel rods, and we've been trying to, you know, get Yucca Mountain for years, and that's a fight, again, for a future Congress. One of the things I will tell you, too, just nuclear in general, and we may even have some, you know, Callaway employees here, friends here, and that is that we are being more efficient in how we process our fuel rods so that we're squeezing out a lot more energy than we were when the Callaway plant was first created or first built. So I support their effort. And as far as how they do this rate dealing with this investment, I will tell you this, that a governor can have sway in this as far as appointment of public service commissioners. Right now, we were just recognized as the number one state in the country as far as manufacturing friendliness. As far as our climate for manufacturing, we were just given an award or got the citation as the most friendly climate for manufacturing. That is not the case as far as energy is concerned. People, main investors in Wall Street and in Chicago, do not think that the climate here has been consistent or stable enough for them to make an investment. That is one of the ways that a governor, through appointments through the Public Service Commission, can show that that we are going to embrace expansion of energy here. And as far as the specifics on whether that's passed on or some other fashion, I'm open to trying to help Ameren do what they must do to expand this plant. I am for that expansion. 3 minutes?
Yes, sir. Now, Kenny, you'll have 3 minutes for a closing statement.
Well, I ask for your endorsement. It's that simple, and it's I stand here as a kid who was taught to dream great dreams. 52 years ago, when a newlywed couple left New Madrid County, and they had $1,000 in their pocket, and that's what their parents had scraped together as their stake to go make their way in the world. And so the new husband wanted to be a farmer, and his new bride wanted to raise a family. And so they found a piece of property in Mississippi County, just outside Charleston, and they put down their roots, and they dreamed great dreams. You know, they dreamed of building a family business. They dreamed of, you know, having a family. And so when my folks survived those early tough times because of their faith and because of their love and because of their work ethic, their faith in God, their faith in each other, and their ability to make a living, and their love for each other, their love for the state, and that strong work ethic, and all of those principles and values, they passed on to their only son. And they said, dream big dreams. And as a kid carried irrigation pipe around an 8-foot tall corn in the heat of July, my dream then was to get off the farm. I'll tell you. And the stake they gave me was a strong home environment and a good education. I call it the Missouri dream. And the fact that I stand here today as the Republican nominee to be the next governor of this great state, that's the Missouri dream. That a kid from the farm who used to walk barefoot on our chopping cotton on our farm, I've walked the marble halls of Congress for a dozen years. That's the Missouri dream. But the Missouri dream should be available for every kid in our state. If you're from downtown Kansas City and your school district's failing you big time, we've got challenges. But the dream should be alive for that young person, or for another kid from the farm, or for a kid from Hannibal, Missouri, where Renee's from, or from anywhere in the state. You should be able to dream about not just having a job here, but a career here, a life here. You should be able to dream having a world-class education right here in the state of Missouri and not have to chase it to some other state or some other land. One of these businesses that, and I'll wrap up, Charlie. One of these businesses that we went to, I'll give you the quick story, down in Webster County in Marshfield. Home company was in Texas. And the plant manager was sent down here saying, you know, we really want to consolidate all of our operations up in Texas. And so ultimately the plan was to close the plant in Missouri. And I stopped by there 2 weeks ago, and they're thriving, expanding. And I said, what happened? You're supposed to shutter this place down. He said, you cannot replicate the work ethic of people in Missouri back in Texas. He said, there's something about the quality of worker in our state. He said, I wish we could bring Texas down here. That is the essence of our people. We are blessed by God, our people and our resources. But we got a lot of challenges, and those challenges are going to require principled leadership and some innovative ideas and the ability to take a stand. And as you've heard me say so many times, leadership is about doing the right thing when nobody's watching you, or it's about doing the hard thing when everybody's watching you. That's the essence of who I am. I ask for your support. I ask for your endorsement. We have had a great 12 years together. Help me continue that strong relationship for another 4 years as your next governor. Thank you very much.